Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
This is Travis Pillow with Redefine Ed. This past weekend, we continued to see major protests in big cities all over the country in the wake of the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, people of color at the hands of police officers. These incidents and the reaction to them have also sparked some soul-searching within the education reform movement. We're hearing a lot of people out there saying, look where we operate, look who we serve. These are people marching in the streets for a cause that's can't be entirely separate from our own. And one of the most powerful responses with that in mind came from Darrell Bradford. He's the executive director of the New York Campaign for Achievement Now, and he's the author of a recent blog post that draws a tight nexus between the death of Eric Garner at the hands of New York City police and the long chain of societal failures that likely took hold before the tragedy struck earlier this year and before the non-indictment that has prompted the latest wave of protest. We recently caught up with Bradford during a break in the action at the Hispanic Creo Conference in Miami. We were speaking outside the conference where, unfortunately, there was some R&B music playing in the background, but don't let that take away from the points that he makes. We started off our conversation really talking about the institutional roots of Eric Garner's victimization, and that's where we'll pick up.
So it's frustrating, right? All the education issues are also economic issues, and all the economic issues are also social issues. And so, I work in New York, and I lived there for a very long time. And by all reckoning, like, the quality of life policing has worked really well there. But I couldn't reconcile the fact that this guy, a black guy, was put in a chokehold and left to die for selling loose cigarettes. And so I started thinking about this, because when I was a kid, I had an aunt, I write about this, he used to send me to get Lucy's for. And you go get loose cigarettes because you can't afford a whole pack of cigarettes. It's less about like trying to be entrepreneurial and more about limited economic ability. And that's all about education. And so for a long time, and I'm thinking about it for a long time, and I've been trying to say it in a way that doesn't make it sound like super conspiracy theorist, but the effect seems to be so clear. Low-income kids in particular, they go to schools that you wouldn't send your dog to or anybody that you love to. And while they are there, they represent tremendous engines of taxation and wealth transfer to whole different groups of people. And it's completely systematic. It happens. It's the one thing that American public ed, particularly in the cities, does really well. Like, everybody gets paid. Everybody collects the dues. Like, no matter what's going on, like, that happens. And in the end, like, we give kids diplomas that they can't read. And what happens to that kid if we've, drained him for 12 years, didn't educate him, turn him out into the world, angry, with no skills? Like, of course they act out, right? They know that they're screwed as much as we know that they're screwed. And in a place like New York, or in a place like Baltimore, or in a place like Chicago, or Los Angeles, whatever, black kids out, acting out in the middle of the street, and what's going to happen? It's going to get arrested. It's going to go to jail. And that is another place where the same sort of like finance transfer happens. In New York City, it costs $161,000 a year to keep someone jailed. The average corrections officer salary is $60,000 a year if they're 10 years in. And you just can't ignore the fact that, again, like, when a person's arrested or a person's in school, they give the state the power to tax, and lots of people make money off of those people. And in the end, when you get out of jail and you don't have any economic power and you got a rap sheet a mile long, Eric Garner in particular had been arrested like 30 times already in his life, including numerous times for selling loose cigarettes. Somebody can put you in a chokehold and you can get killed, and no one pays a price for that. And to me, like, what is so vicious and terrible about it is not that it happened, but that it was mechanical how it happened. The looking at what's happened to Garner, what happened to Mike Brown, what's happened to tons of other, young black men in particular, because that's the flashpoint that we're all focused around right now. But it's really lots of poor kids in terrible schools overall. Is that they have gone through these two systems that really articulate with one another elegantly and at a very high level. They've had precisely what was supposed to happen to them happen to them, and at the end they were disposable. And I don't see how we can be people who care about education, who care about the potential of every child, who don't weigh in on the fact that these two things link up this way.
So you mentioned that linkage between the education system and the criminal justice system, and one of the things that was striking to me was, if you look at the chain of events that put Eric Garner in that position, I see one institutional failure after another. The institutions, it seems like they failed. But then you're saying, what the impression that I got was that they did what they were designed
didn't fail,
to do.
Right.
Right. So how do you explain that? Like, the system worked the way the system was built. How is that exactly?
Yeah, so this is, I was at a bar a very long time ago, although it won't surprise you that I was at a bar. A guy sat down next to me, he's a black guy, older, an engineer. And this is when I first started working in education reform, and he was asking me about what I did or whatever, and at one point he said to me, maybe you should consider that the results that you are getting are not because something is working poorly, but because something is working well. And like all my MBA friends are, they're basically like, look, systems do what they're designed to do. So faced with the overwhelming reams of data that we have about, even if you take away all the excuses, right? Look, even if you bought the excuses of the other guys, there are hundreds of thousands of kids who are graduating from schools where they have no life potential after they get done with them, or very little. And so many of those kids go to prison and do the same thing. It can't be random because it keeps happening so well and efficiently. This one thing I want to say, I know this is in the blog, which you can go read, but I don't think the world is one that's filled with predatory teachers and horrible cops, right? I do think that there are two subsets of this conversation that are happening at the same time, and they're really close to one another. In one circle, there is your likelihood, particularly if you are a minority male or black male, to get shot by a police officer. Any police officer, not just a white police officer, any police officer. In the other circle, there are the socioeconomic and, more importantly, the educational factors that would increase the amount of overlap you have with the first circle. And so when I look at the Garner case, that overlap is like 99%. It's not 100. It's actually really important that it's not 100. But not understanding that, like, how well you're educated or the failure to educate a kid totally increases the overlap of these two things. It's a huge lost opportunity.
And the people in the education movement whose area is education, why is this our issue? What is our call back?
The other day I was tweeting with somebody, not trying to be malicious about it, but I was like, you have to understand that when you're a guy and you're black and you're walking down the street, education is the only armor you have. It could be thick or thin, and it could still be pierced, but it is there. And it's just an important thing to consider. So two things. One is, we need more allies. And I know lots of people who the criminal justice system is working just like the unperforming education system. The same things are happening, and it's the same people that it's happening to. And so I don't know what that looks like, but I feel like now is an opportunity for us as a movement to make new, important allies who are equally involved, who care equally about helping people be free intellectually and in their person, right? And that's a higher level discussion for a movement, but there's never been a better time to have it other than now. The other thing I think we have to realize is just like, from a policy standpoint, I think it's a really good one. I'm deeply concerned that people think tweeting out Black Lives Matter means that they have done their part. And I'm also deeply concerned that there is no clear articulation to a goal in lots of the protesting. I mean, I get that it's cathartic, it is important, I'm happy that it is happening. But there's no bill, there's no, other than the fact that the federal government might look into some of these things, there's no sort of wholesale list of things that are going to happen that are going to change the way police interact with, you know, minority men on the street in big cities or whatever. And so to me, like, the best thing we can do, again, right, is help the very people we've been trying to serve understand, A, the linkage between not knowing how to read and going to an underperforming school, your life potential and your likelihood of being in prison and these bad things happening to you. That's A. And B, that the things that we care about from a public policy perspective are the things that are most likely to make sure that the overlap between those two circles is not 99%, or not 50%, or not 25%. It's 1%, or it's random. Smaller point on this. Lots of people give the education reform movement a bad rap on our community engagement because they say you're only here to talk about your education thing. You're not here when our communities need you to support us and other issues. And I can understand that, right? I mean, that's a practical concern. I feel like there is something going on now that gives us an opportunity to do what we've been doing for the last 30 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever, while meeting the communities that are most affected where they are. And the way that's supposed to look, like, I actually think it would be bad if we decided the way it was supposed to look before going and talking to the people. But, you know, kids are dying, right? Like, I can remember this one time my uncle, when I was a kid, he got pulled over. He was in his car, and he got pulled over by the police wrongly. And he came home, and he was just a wreck, right? And I was 10 or 11 years old, and I knew he was really upset, but I didn't really understand it. And then watching all this unfold, I'm looking back at this and you know, he came home, right? Like he didn't have a college degree, but he was a smart guy and he had a good job and he came home alive. He navigated that, situation. And what we keep seeing now is that, like, there are lots of people who aren't very well educated, who don't have a lot of opportunity, who for lots of reasons either aren't able to navigate that situation, or not given the opportunity to navigate that situation. And if that's not an education issue, I don't know what is.
So if I could try to take it and, like, distill it into a bumper sticker, what I'm kind of hearing is we're confronted with these major high-profile tragedies that have prompted soul-searching in some communities. And so now is the time for us as an education movement to go into those communities and listen to what they're saying, listen to what their problems are, and try to become part of the solution.
You said that much more succinctly and eloquently than I did. But it's like, you know, I think we got to be, so I didn't write about Ferguson. I wrote about this because I had to, because I felt like it was clearer and it was a better place to sort of take a stand on these things. I think we'd be very cognizant of the fact that we could look like we're being opportunistic. You know, I saw this thing online the other day where, like, the Occupy movement is trying to reboot around this. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, Occupy was not about this. It was about taking on one percenters and economic justice, you know, whatever. It's not about social justice as it is catalyzed by economic inequity, whatever. So with that in mind, though, I do think we have a chance to put some of the dogs that have been howling at us, like, you know, to sleep on this thing. It should be thoughtful. It should be done in a way that respects the people we want to partner with. And in a lot of respects, you know, we're partnered with these people already. We have schools in a lot of their communities. We have kids on tax credit programs. We're implementing huge teacher evaluation systems and pay structures that are meant to get great teachers into the communities that Eric Garner's come out of. But the escalating that beyond, like, the intentional system stuff of school change is something that we have not done. And if there was ever a time to do it, we should do it now.
Okay. Is there anything else about this that you think people in the school choice and education reform movement in Florida really should be thinking about?
So this is a really interesting thing. So I feel like you said soul searching earlier. I just feel like now is a time where people should be exploring the things in their lives that were positive and that helped kids of color become truly free and the people they were meant to be, right? So if it's writing about a kid that was a Step Up for Student scholarship recipient in a way that helps other people understand, like, that program saved a life, right? And ultimately will make others in the future because that kid lived and was prosperous and a citizen, you know, we should be doing that. If there's an opportunity to give testimonial, you know, in front of people, to speak to folks, or just to break bread with people, like in social contexts around the lives of the children that we're trying to help and the stories that we have because of them, I think we should be doing that. This is not, as much as we need a public policy goal, this is not a public policy moment. This is an emotional moment where people are desperately trying to figure out who they can trust, all kinds of people. And we have a real opportunity to help people understand the reasons why we do what we do. And we haven't had something like this in a very long time.